Basically, we're up to approximately Perek Zayin in Shmuel Bet. And what has happened is that once the Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, has been brought to Jerusalem, and of course there were some accidents on the way, but at this point, David contemplates the fact that he is dwelling in a very comfortable palace, and the Ark of God is simply in a tent, and therefore David has a great desire to build a Beit HaMikdash, to build a temple and a sanctuary for God. And Natan the prophet, Natan seems to be the prophet in chief after Shmuel died. In fact, according to rabbinic interpretation, Natan is the author who completed the book of Shmuel after the death of Shmuel. Natan first tells David, go ahead. Natan figures it's a great idea, and God comes to Natan and says, you have to tell David that that's not the case. Now, I pointed out that in Divrei HaYamim, in Chronicles, which gives the same story, the famous reason is given, because you are a man of war, you are a man of bloodshed, and my house must be built only by one who is a man of peace. Ironically, in the account in Shmuel, that reason is not given at all. And in fact, there is no reason that is given why David does not build the Beit HaMikdash. What God seems to do is, God de-emphasizes the importance of a Beit HaMikdash. God says, you know, I don't need a house. Did I ever ask you for a house before? I'm fine. The discrepancies are very, very interesting, meaning to say the account in Shmuel casts no aspersion at all on David's role. Divrei HaYamim, however, does supply us with the missing detail. The way this is it's an interesting point, because a lot of Divrei HaYamim specifically tries to make David look good. For example, all of the chapters of Avshalom and Bathsheba, all of the sordid details that occupy the second half of Shmuel Bet are totally omitted in Divrei HaYamim, because Divrei HaYamim basically portrays David in a more positive light, and yet this particular detail only appears in Chronicles. It does not appear in the book of Shmuel. But if you look at chapter 7, there are some actually very, very lofty sentiments that one should be aware of. I just want to point out a few verses. First, let us look at what God told Natan to tell David. And the verse I want to point out to you is Pasuk Yud Bet, verse 12. This is chapter 7, verse 12. Ki yimlu yamecha, your days shall be filled, which is a euphemism for death. V'shachavta et avosecha, and you will lie with your forefathers. Again, a common expression for departing this world. V'akimoti et zaracha acharecha, and I will establish your seed after you. Asher yetzei mimeyecha, that will come from your loins. V'achinoti et mamachto, I will establish his kingdom. Hu yivna bayit lishmi, he shall build the house for my name. V'konanti et kisei mamachto, and I will establish his throne forever. But in particular, look at verse 14, which is a very, very sublime concept of what is a parent. Ani eyelo la'av, I will be a father to your child. V'hu yeli ben, and he will be a son. But what does that mean? I share b'havato, that when he does something wrong, v'hochachtiv b'shevet anashim, I will rebuke him with the staff of people, meaning there will be human enemies against him, u'v'nigei b'nei adam, and with various plagues. In other words, what God is saying is that a true parent is not someone who simply lets a child do whatever the child wants.
That's true.
A true parent is someone who provides guidance and instruction and allows the child to experience the negative consequences of negative and destructive behaviors. And God is saying, if Solomon and his descendants will undergo punishment, it is not the punishment of rejection or hatred. It is the punishment of a parent that is concerned with a child. And that itself is the greatest blessing, that God cares enough about the behavior of the Jewish people. Now again, I'm not offering this at all as an explanation for all of the tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people. That is not, that would be too big of a burden for this verse to bear. But it is certainly making the point that God's punishment is not regarded as hatred or rejection, but it's regarded as instruction and chastisements. And that's why King David HaMelech says in the 23rd Psalm, Shiftecha u'mishantecha hema yenachamuni, your stick and your staff lead me or comfort me or support me. And what is the difference between a shevet and a mishenet? A shevet is the staff that hits you. Just in fact, this is exactly the word that's used here. I will rebuke him with the shevet, with the stick. The mishenet is the cane on which you lean on. King David says that in life, there will sometimes be a shevet, a staff of chastisement, and there will sometimes be a mishenet of comfort. But King David says, as long as I know they come from you, God, Hema Yenachamuni, I will get comfort even from the chastisement, because ultimately it is designed to let me find a deeper meaning in my life. Again, I just refer, as I often do, to Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, in which he argued that even in the depths of despair of the Holocaust, as unfathomable as those tragedies are, human beings, and Jews in particular, were able to find meaning to their life in how they responded to that tragedy. That a human being often has no choice regarding the adversities of life. We don't have a lot of control over many of those things, but the one thing we do have control over is how we choose to respond to them. That choice is the last human freedom, which cannot be taken away even under slavery and oppression and great suffering. One can choose to be broken and destroyed, or one can choose to rise to the challenge with nobility and with compassion and with grace. And the allusion that God is making to David is that your children are not going to have an easy time of it. Life is not going to be a smooth journey. There will be a lot of bumps. There'll be a lot of harshness. There'll be a lot of things that look like punishment and rejection. But in fact, I'm sending it as a father, as a parent, would send it to a child, so that the child would respond in the proper way. So that itself, and of course, one might also say, maybe this is a bit of a veiled rebuke to David, because we will see a number of times that David himself is criticized because he did not discipline his own children. Avshalom and Eliezer. Yes.
Verse 7, chapter 7.
Before
she dropped the former Israel on Dava. Now, that hay there, can I be considered an interrupter of hay?
Yes. Yes, that isn't that exactly it is. Hagar, that is an interrogative. Have I ever asked? That is correct. Now, one thing, this concept, by the way, that the temple needs to be built by a person of peace and not a person of war, does have a resonance even in contemporary halakha. For example, there is a law that when we recite Birkat HaMazon, there's an old custom that all knives are removed from the table. And the reason is, a Jewish table in which one eats in honor of God is like an altar. And when it comes to an altar, you don't have metal. Like, you don't use metal tools in the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, because Barzel Nivra L'Katzer Yamav Shel Adam, iron was created as a way of shortening people's lives.
Yeah,
Barzel Nivra L'Katzer Yamav Shel Adam. Barzel's iron shortens people's lives. The temple was designed to bring life into the world. So we, in fact, that's why we had a whole question. The whole big question, of course, is how were the stones cut for the Beit HaMikdash if you could not use iron tools? So there are midrashim about the miraculous little insect called the shamir that kind of used to eat rocks, right? Moshe Shamir is aptly named. In fact, it probably is why he took the name, because these are basically these are assumed names. Be it as it may, the halacha does say that one removes knives from the table before Birkat HaMazon. Although there's another reason that's given. Reason number one is because you don't want to associate the iron, which is a tool of death, with the shulchan, which is a mizbeach. The other reason is a more prosaic reason. It was recorded that when a person was asking God to rebuild Jerusalem, he was so overcome with grief that he stabbed himself. and therefore it was enacted from that day forward that we remove all dangerous knives from the table, so people shouldn't get caught up with it. That's why some opinions say on Shabbat you can leave the knife, because on Shabbat, in which you're in a happier mood, that's less likely to happen. So you'll actually find kind of a strange custom that knives are removed during the week, but knives are not removed on Shabbat. So again, these are different customs, whatever you do. you will not be excommunicated for either version. But with all of these customs, some of which are very little known, you know, have a very have, you know, deep sources and interesting sources.
Yeah.
All the flat. Well, okay. Move the spoon. Well, that's right. From these maximum security prisons, when they don't want to commit suicide, they take away all the spoons. They don't have any metal at all.
No shoelaces.
No shoelaces. That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. Alrighty. So that's just a very, very sublime idea that I think one should be aware of. That the true love that a parent has for a child, again, I'm not referring to any specific way of punishment, that's a separate matter, is not to just let things go, but to, you know, intervene to try to make things better. Because the love, which is simply the apathy of letting a person do whatever they want to do, is really much more of an indifference than a real care. Okay, but be it as it may, David is now. Here's one detail that really you don't see very much in the book of Shmuel, but in Divrei HaYamim you have chapters and chapters, and that is, we get the impression casually that David wanted to build a temple. God said no, so that's the end of it, and the whole thing was left for King Solomon. In point of fact, all of the raw materials for the Beit HaMikdash, the wood, the gold, the silver, the copper, the architectural plans for the Beit HaMikdash, were all drawn up by David. Now, there is only one mention, there is a single mention in the book of Shmuel, if you may recall it, an oblique reference that all of the gold and silver that David accumulated from his conquests, he dedicated to the temple. That's the only reference, like one line. In the book of Chronicles, it is given much more detail. In fact, it's very interesting, huh? The book of Chronicles was written by Ezra, so this was written after the Babylonian exile. Ezra recounted. It was written much later. One can make, now there's still no real convincing, clear explanation of why Divrei HaYamim, you know, contains things that are not in the book of Shmuel or Kings, and vice versa. But just to point out, just for your information, some of the outstanding differences are, number one, the whole story of Bathsheba and Avshalom does not appear at all in Chronicles. It only appears in Shmuel. And number two, the detailed plans that David made for the Beit HaMikdash only appears in Chronicles. It does not appear in Shmuel. I don't have an explanation other than to call to your attention that particular phenomenon.
But weren't they involved in rebuilding the temple?
That could be. That might be an explanation that, in effect, the Jewish people need an encouragement to be engaged in the building of the second temple, so they're reminded in more detail about the glories of David accumulating the first temple. And in fact, we are told that although Shlomo was the one who built or, you know, supervised the building of the first temple, it is still considered to be the contribution of David. In fact, you know, when we put back the Torah, so we say Uvnucho Yomar when the ark was at rest, right? When we put back the Torah and Shabbat, Monday and Thursday, whenever we read the Torah. So we have a pasuk that says, Bavur David Avdecha, for the sake of David, your servant, Al Tashev Pnei Meshichecha, do not turn back your anointed one. Now, what is that pasuk talking about? That pasuk actually has a context. It's a pasuk in Malachim. And according to the Midrash says that when the ark was going to be brought into the temple, which is not what David did because there was no temple yet, but when the ark was transferred from the tent in Jerusalem to the ark, to the Holy of Holies, the doors of the temple locked themselves and they refused to open up. Because basically they felt that Shlomo had a number of faults and they were not going to allow Shlomo to bring the Holy Ark into the temple. And that is that reference that we see in the 24th Psalm, Su'u Sharim Rasheichem, open up gates, V'yavo Melech HaKavod, so the King of Glory can come. And that didn't work. Shlomo is calling on those gates to open up for God and they remain locked. And finally, The one way that the gates opened is when Shlomo said, Bavur David Avdecha, for the sake of David your servant, do not turn me away. So in point of fact, we are told that the Beit HaMikdash was really, in many, many ways, the spiritual child of David, although physically it was not built, except by Shlomo. So these psukim, you know, have context, and there are midrashim on these psukim, etc., that they refer often to historical events. And of course, since the midrashim are not bound by concepts of historical causality, that is why in the Psalms, which were supposed to be written by David, we will have references to things that happened, you know, much, much later, that either David was alluding to, or perhaps there were later authors who added. Because again, even under traditional understanding, we don't have to say that, in fact we know this, not all 150 Psalms were written by David. He may have been the primary author. But for example, we have identified authors. We have Tefillah LeMoshe. We have a psalm that was written by Moses, right? So
it says,
we have a psalm of the Babylonian exile, right? So even the most traditional approach recognizes that Tehillim is a composite of many, many authors, but the traditional view is that the bulk of it were written by David, at least if there's no contrary indication there. Okay, same thing with Proverbs, by the way. Although Proverbs is identified as the Proverbs of Shlomo, but still, there are other people who are mentioned there. Some of them are very obscure. Agur, Ben Yakeh, other wise people of the time whose Proverbs were attached to the Proverbs of Shlomo.
The thousand women, when did you have time for Isaac?
Well, yeah, that was a problem.
When he didn't sleep.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Okay, so that brings us now. Let's just see 1 second here. Yeah, Parakhet. Again, I apologize for going over this fairly quickly, but as I say, time runs out. As I say, Hayom Katsar Vamlacha Merupa. Okay, the day is short. Okay, in chapter 8. We have, yes, chapter 8 does have that verse that I referred to. Let me just call it, this is the one verse in Shmuel that indicates that David consecrated his gold and silver for the benefit of the Beit HaMikdash. So I'll just show you that pasuk.
Verse 11.
Okay, that's an important pasuk. And now in Chronicles, this goes on for several chapters. Gamotam hiktish melech David Lashem. David consecrated them for God. Imakesav azahav asher hiktish mikol ha-goyim asher kibesh. From all of the goyim, all of the nations that he conquered. Now a short list of conquests, just to indicate the lessons. Number one, he did conquer a major city of the Philistines. Of course, remember, the Philistines never get conquered. Remember this. In other words, they're always around, and there will always be skirmishes, you know, to the end of the destruction of the kingdom of Judea. So all that you get is, you get a little territory, you're victorious over a skirmish. But it does say that David conquered a city of the Philistines called Metek Ha'amah, which is identified as Gat. Gat, of course, was a major, major city of the Philistines, and it was considered to be the capital and the seat of their monarchy. He did conquer much territory of Moab. Now again, remember who the Moabites are? Just in terms, of course, we just read about a very, very famous Moabite who was none other than David's own great-grandmother. That was Ruth the convert. But of course, the Moabites themselves murdered David's parents and brothers, according to Chazal. And the Moabites came from Lot, and they were the product of Lot's incest with his oldest daughter after the destruction of Sodom. And the word Moab means from my father, Me'av, and that was the name. And the Moabites, again, were given a certain amount of David, took the Moabites that he captured, we're not given a number, he lay them down on the ground against a rope, he had a long rope, he then measured two-thirds the length of the rope, and he murdered two-thirds, and one-third survived. It was kind of a particular, we're not really clear what the point of this is, other than to combine killing some of his enemies with a certain sense of them being humiliated before they died as well. In other words, the concept would be everybody lies down, and then the rope is measured, and if you're within the first two-thirds of the length, you're in trouble. And if you're within the latter third, I guess people didn't know which way he would start measuring, and that's part of the uncertainty.
Or?
Oh, no. This is in the pasuk. This is not even. This is in chapter 8 itself. You see, the problem basically is if you're in trouble, if you're the first two-thirds, and you're saved if you're the last third, it all depends which side we start measuring from. And since people didn't know, so they had that fear of dying. Now, again, it's hard to have a convincing explanation for all of this. Chazal allude to the fact that David was enraged over the fact that they had murdered his parents and brother, and, you know, rightfully so. But again, in classical understanding, we don't necessarily have a notion of collective guilt in that sense. Were these the murderers of his parents, or were these just the nation? Right? So it is difficult to fully understand this. It does, and also we're not told how many people he did this to, because the bulk of the Moabites, we are told, became subjects of David and the payers of tribute, meaning he did not murder one-third of the entire people, but he just took a certain group and used them as an example. I'm sorry, yeah?
Is there any place where it's written, you know, like Abraham, you know, really, really deep deal,
right.
His daughters, and
right.
He was the, you know, father of the Moabites, so
yes.
It was always kind of like a thorn
right.
in the
mm-hmm.
eyes of the Israelites. So
mm-hmm.
is there anything like written as to, like, you know, this is a good thing that came out of this, you know, from his bargaining and
of course, but that's a big outside of, right? Because basically the Davidic line came. In fact, the point is made that because of Avraham's prayer that resulted in Lot being saved, Rut was able to enter the world. And because Rut was able to enter the world, David HaMelech entered the world, and ultimately Mashiach. So in fact, Avraham's prayer really culminated and will culminate in the coming of the Redeemer. So it is a very, very significant prayer. There are a lot of bumps on the way, but that prayer is very, very meaningful. In fact, Rav Tzadok points out, this should remind a person, one of the great Hasidic rabbis points out, that we should never disparage the efficacy of a prayer. Sometimes a person prays, and they only seem to get nothing that they really ask for, or just a very, very little bit, and it doesn't seem to have any significance. But sometimes the ultimate significance of what a person gets cannot be measured for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Avraham prays to have Sodom saved. God saves only one person, or, you know, three people from Sodom, and yet this is Malchut Beit David, this is Mashiach, this is everything. Of course, it is, of course, paradoxical that David should come from Moab, Mashiach should come from Moab. Moab is such a corrupt nation, a nation that is founded in incest. Although that's not the reason we condemn them. We do not condemn them because they were founded in incest. If you look in the Torah, when the Torah says that the Moabites shall not enter the congregation of God, which only applies to the males, not the females. That's why Ruth is allowed to enter. It does not say because the Moabites had their genesis in incest. It says very specifically because when you were in the desert and you needed food and water, they refused to give you food and water. In other words, it is not the incest that is the evil here. The evil is callousness and cruelty. And a lack of concern for people who were needy. And that is considered to be something that's very, very, very severe character defect. In a sense, David is showing them extreme cruelty. That doesn't justify it, as it were, but there is kind of a midah keneged midah, a behavior which corresponds to their behavior. Yes.
By force and war and capture instead of being dug up and things naturally.
So you're saying that you're right. So you're saying if the temple is a temple of peace, so your argument is the same way that the man of war should not construct the temple, perhaps there ought to be a similar concept that the materials of the temple itself should not be constructed of spoils of war. Yeah, well, that's a good observation. I do want to point out.
Huh?
Say again?
I thought Shlomo turned down the spoils of war. He went and got from Lebanon.
Well, but those were extra things. Certainly, the foundation of the Beis HaMikdash was David's spoil. But again, I want to emphasize, though, that in a lot of these, although David's reaction appears to be very, very cruel, but a lot of these were, in fact, defensive wars, meaning to say that the Moabites, the Philistines, they were not simply staying where they were and we go and we conquer them. Rather, they were attacking. They were attacking Jews. They were killing Jews. So David's wars were largely, not entirely, in fact, I'll mention one that was not, but were largely wars of defense, although in the course of defense, you know, acts of aggression were performed. So basically, at least the initiation of these conflicts on the part of David was, in fact, justifiable as a defensive measure. No, that is not. That is a midrash. That is a midrash. It is not recorded. It is recorded in Tanakh that when David was running away from Shaul, he sent his parents over to the Moabites for safe haven. It doesn't say what happened to them. So there is such a midrash that way. So we have the Philistine.
The Moabite did not allow Israel to pass. That's in the Bible.
Oh, yes. But that's much earlier. That goes back to the desert. Yeah. Now, I'm just referring to the idea that the Moabites murdered David's parents is not recorded in the Tanakh.
Oh, it's not.
That's
a midrash?
That's a midrash, yeah.
Is it ever referred to as a Moabite, as descendants of Moabite in the Bible?
Oh, sure, all the time. And in fact, according to many commentaries, the Book of Ruth, who is the author? I don't know if we talked about it. The Book of Ruth was actually authored by Shmuel, was the Book of Ruth. And he authored the Book of Ruth to legitimate the lineage of David HaMelech. That's correct. And the reason why he needed legitimation is that David was constantly, with his, David had a lot of enemies, Shaul and all, I mean, and the people who were loyalists to Shaul, Tories, right, whatever you want to call them. And a lot of the enemies claimed that David was an illegitimate Jew because he was descended from the tainted Moabite converts, where the Torah says they cannot enter the congregation of God. Now, halacha, that's not a problem, because halacha, the condemnation is only for the male Moabite and not for the female, because the females could not be expected to bring food and water to a foreign army. But this was an aspersion. And in fact, it is said, therefore, that Shmuel wanted to show that there's a precedent, that a great man, Boaz, who was known as a leader of his generation, married Ruth in a public ceremony. And that was to kind of legitimate the lineage of David HaMelech. So with all the beautiful reasons why we read Ruth on Shavuot, but the actual reason why Ruth was originally written was to validate the legitimacy of David as a Jew, not as a king, just as a Jew, because of the claim. So this concept of aspersions being cast on David because he was of Moabite origin were very, very frequent. But as I say, halachically, that's not a problem, because halachically, it only applies to the male Moabite and their descendants, and not to the female Moabite, even to the male descendants of a female Moabite.
Yep. That no mention is made of her converting to Judaism.
Well, you know, it all depends how you understand this. There is no reference to a formal conversion process, but the rabbis of the Talmud understand that the whole, you know, beautiful statement, your nation is my nation, your people are my people, your God is my God, all of that is understood as a conversion process. It doesn't say, that's right. That's correct. And that is the source of the principle that the person who wants to convert should initially be discouraged.
There's no rabbi involved.
Well, you know, here's a big thought. I'll tell you where the... Yeah, no rabbi. No one's an actual rabbi involved. Yeah, who knows? Maybe Naomi was a rabbi, but I don't know. But the thing is, I'll tell you, where there is a lot of controversy, is... Machlon and Chilya, these were the two sons, when they seem to have married Ruth and Orpah, that seems to be pre-conversion, because number one, Orpah never converted, apparently, but number two, even Ruth, her conversion, if you look at it as good, seems to take place later when Naomi urges her to go back. Now, that leads to the conclusion that Mahlon and Chilion married totally non-Jewish women before conversion.
That's why they died.
Oh, so one second. Now, you might say, now, according to Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, which is one of the early Midrashic commentators, he actually says that the sin of Mahlon and Chilion was that they married non-Jewish women. But that's not the mainstay. That's not really indicating the text. And I'll tell you another question with that. Because the whole fourth chapter in Ruth's, in which Boaz marries Ruth, etc., and there's a whole ceremony there, seems to parallel a mitzvah in the Torah that's called Yibam, right? Yibam means when a man dies without a child. Now, it's not real Yibam because Boaz wasn't the brother, so it's not technical Yibam, but it's spiritual Yibam. The concept is you perpetuate.
Rabbi, yeah. It was a real Yibam because he asked the first relative of Ruth, and he refused her.
I understand, but it couldn't be real. Real Yibam is only a brother. A brother. Boaz was a cousin, actually. Boaz was not a brother. But still, the concept of perpetuating the soul of the deceased is what that marriage is about. Now, here we have a very simple halakhic question. If we posit that Mahlon had married a woman prior to her conversion, and he had died when she was still a non-Jew who did not embrace Judaism, the marriage is a nullity. The marriage is null and void. So there would be no mitzvah at all of perpetuating that union.
So
that would have...
The child is considered the child of Boaz, not the child of Mahlon, right?
Actually, it seems to be considered to be the child of Mahlon in many ways.
Well, why wasn't he called by
him? In fact, not only...
No.
Well, let's be very practical. I mean, if a person is miyabeng, if a person marries his brother's widow and has a child, that child is called up to the Torah by the biological father. There's no question about that. So in terms of lineage is lineage, but in a spiritual sense, there's actually a linkage. In fact, not only that, if you read the narrative of Ruth, not only was Boaz's child considered to be a child of Mahlon, it was considered to be Mahlon incarnate. Because the neighbors, right, the neighbors have a very prominent role, the female neighbors. They say, behold, a son has been born to Naomi. And Ruth is a very, very forgiving mother. I mean, she kind of lets her mother-in-law take over the show. It's like the Ruth, like, you know, is the incubator. She gives birth to the child. It says, like a surrogate mother almost. Naomi takes the child. It even says, I don't know if this is meant to be, physiologically the fact, that Naomi seems to nurse the child. Right? And all the neighbors say, behold, a son has been born to Naomi, which suggests that this is actually a replacement for Mahlon himself. But the point I'm making is, that, again, if you analyze this from the perspective of halakha, it couldn't have been a Yibam type of situation if Ruth was non-Jewish at the time of her marriage to Mahlon, right? So you're stuck with certain problems.
Goel, you refer to him as a Goel. Would that have been a different kind of... aside from the Yibam?
Goel seems to be the concept of Yibam. In other words, you redeem the death of someone who died without a child. You redeem him from his death state by perpetuating his life. I mean, that's the concept, right? You're redeeming him from death. You're giving him an eternity.
It's not necessarily a brother.
Well, the mitzvah, okay, so the Ramban explains the mandatory aspect of Yibam is only a brother, but the truth is any relative can kind of fill the role. A cousin could fill the role as well. By the way, today, for a variety of reasons, you know, this is still a mitzvah, but Ashkenazim do not practice Yibam. So, for example, if a person dies without the children, the Ashkenazic custom is a brother does not marry the widow. But if he does not, there is still a requirement before she can marry anyone else. There is equivalent of a get, but it's not a get, it's called chalitza.
This is true in Israel, I understand.
Not just in Israel, I mean, in Baltimore. I mean, you know.
Really? No, in Baltimore.
This is not like I mean, this is not like King Arthur, and this is not like, you know, one shoe. No. Just it is an especially constructed boots. In other words, it's not any shoe. You know, it has to be a boot like with straps and laces.
Sandal.
Right, like it has to be a sandal. The person wears it without any socks directly on
What's
the foot.
What's the idea behind it?
Well, I'll explain in a minute. And the concept is she pulls off his boot and spits at him, not in his face. It says in front of him, and says, "So shall be done to the man who refuses to rebuild his brother's home." And that ceremony of chalitza, which is removal of the shoe, is equivalent, as it were, to a get, meaning she needs that in order to be able to remarry. Now, what bothers me is that, you know, in the olden days, where yibum was an option, and chalitza was if he didn't want, so I see the meaning of the ceremony. I really don't understand myself what that ceremony means, where, you know, yibum, let's say the guy says, "I want to do it." We say, "No, you can't." You know? So she takes off the shoe and spits at him. You know, it's a little difficult what that ceremony means in that context. But that is required even today. And again,
is it practiced today?
Even if he's what? Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Even if the brother is already married.
Well, under Torah law, he could have two wives. So, more than that. Yeah. In fact, Svartim can have more than one wife even today. So you know, you're, you know.
Yeah. In my neighborhood, there was a pastry maker with three wives. Mm-hmm.
Well, absolutely. It must be done. It must be done. Now, the Baal Shem Tov gives a beautiful explanation for the removal of the shoe. And the Baal Shem Tov says, the concept is when a person dies without a child, in other words, we always talk about a child as your eternity, meaning your life somehow goes on because your seed continues after you. A person dies without children, right, they're dead, because, although not really, because we say good deeds are also children, that's true also, don't forget that, but in a biological sense, they're dead because there's no perpetuation of their life. So the concept is this: when a man refuses the opportunity to perpetuate his brother's life, it is as if he killed his brother a second time. And the Baal Shem Tov says, when you're sitting in mourning, you take off your shoes. That's like sitting Shiva, right? So she takes off the shoe and says, "Mourn for your brother again, because you declined the opportunity to perpetuate his life." But chalitza, again, for various reasons, there aren't that many cases of chalitza. I don't know why. Statistically, there shouldn't be more. It doesn't happen that much. But indeed, there is a mitzvah of chalitza. I want to emphasize, too, by the way, that since this requires biological children, so even if a person adopts a child and then would die without a biological child, there would still be a requirement of a ritual of chalitza. There would still be such a requirement. Yeah.
Question of Yerusha
also? Yes. The halakha is that the brother who does yibum succeeds to all of his brother's assets. He becomes his heir. Of course, chalitza, you don't do that, so today it'll be
not
secure.
A bad business.
Well, you know, yeah, but as they say, Ashkenazim do not do. Svartim still practice Yibum. Ashkenazim do not. Okay. By the way, just I don't want to get into Rut too much. The taking off of the shoe at the end of Rut, although, remember when the other Redeemer turned down the opportunity, one is very tempted to say, "Oh, isn't that chalitza?" But the answer is it's not. It's not. It shouldn't be confused. And the reason it's chalitza is that because if you have, let's say, two people who are able to do yibum and one doesn't want to do it, there's no chalitza. In other words, chalitza is only if nobody's doing yibum. Actually, that was not. That was simply a symbolic transfer where the Redeemer is giving up his rights to Boaz. That's a different process. That's not a chalitza per se. That's simply a renunciation of rights. First of all, chalitza would involve Rut taking off the shoe, not Boaz and the guys, right? So it's very reminiscent of chalitza, and of course it's right in the talking about yibum, so it seems to be tempting to identify it as chalitza, but it actually is not. It is a different process that was going on there. How did I get onto this? I don't remember at all.
Question
Moabites. Moabites, okay. Alrighty. Now, again, Philistines, Moabites, Hadad-Ezer, the king of Tsova. Tsova is basically where Damascus is, so David even extended his territory to Damascus. Maybe wouldn't be a bad idea today. And then he went south into Edomite territory. Edomite, of course, are Esav, and the Edomite territory is northern Saudi Arabia. And so David's empire did extend past the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel. It went northwest and a little southeast, right? The Edomites to the south, and some parts of Syria, which is Aram, to the north. There's an interesting halachic discussion, which I'll just allude to. We don't have to focus too much about it. And that is, we know that the land of Israel has special mitzvot, mitzvah of truma, taking off tithing and the like. What is the status of conquered areas beyond the biblical boundaries of the land of Israel? Did they have to take off trumot and masrot in Syria or Damascus? That wouldn't be today, but you know, at the time when they were conquered. The Gemara has different discussions regarding the status, the halachic status of those conquered areas, whether there was a chiyuv, an obligation of trumot and masrot. There is one final pasuk in chapter... I want to go back a second. I just want to call your attention to one more verse in chapter 7. This is in David's prayer to God, prayer of thanksgiving. There's a pasuk that we recite in our prayers. Let's see if you can guess, remember where this is. This is chapter 7, verse 23. I apologize for backtracking. It says, Umi ki amcha ki Yisrael, who is like your nation Israel, gayachad biaretz, a unique nation in the world. First of all, you see, by the way, that the word goy doesn't have to be a goy, right? That the goy means a nation, and the Jewish people themselves can be referred to as goy. Okay, that's one thing. Does anyone remember who is like your nation Israel, a unique nation in the world? Shabbat Mincha. Okay, we forgive it if you don't know that. Yeah, that's Mincha. Okay, that Shabbat Mincha, we say, Atayachad, you are one, and your name is one, and who is like your nation Israel, one nation in the world. So we say this Shabbat Mincha, but there's another use of this pasuk, which is amazing, and that is, the Talmud says, and this is, I can't explain this rationally at all, that God wears tefillin. Have you ever heard this? You know, we know that God wears tefillin. God has tefillin of the hand, whatever the hand of God means, and God wears tefillin on the head. Now we know, in our tefillin, we have the parsha of the Shema, which talks about the unity of God. But what is contained in God's tefillin? Verses which talk about the greatness of the Jewish people. And one of the verses that is cited is, Mi Kamcha Yisrael. So in our head and our heart, we have a constant reminder of the greatness of God. And Kav Yachol, meaning not to be taken literally, but in God's head and God's heart, is the love that he has for the Jewish people. And in fact, in Anim Zemiret, which we sing right? So there's a verse that says, Pe'ero Alai, Ufe'iri Alev. Now what does that mean? Pe'ero Alai. His glory is upon me. That's a direct reference to the tefillin, which the glory of God is on my head and my hands, although we don't wear tefillin on Shabbat. Upe'iri, and my glory, Alev, is on God. That refers to the tefillin of God. It's a mystical reference. Now, all of Adam's Mirrors, by the way, is a very, very mystical song. We give it to a child, but the truth is it's a very, very mystical song with many allusions to the Zohar and the Kabbalah and the like. And the reference to his glory is upon me and my glory is upon him is a reference to the tefillin of God, which contained the verse, Mi Kam Chesu. Now, again, We don't understand this literally, of course, because...
Who says it?
The Gemara says it. The Talmud says it.
The Gemara
says it. Absolutely.
God has filled it?
Absolutely, yes.
Which rabbi?
Which
I'll take away Smith.
Okay. Yeah. Now, again, you have to understand, I mean, these things are not understood in physical, material terms. God does not have an arm, although we talk about the hand of God. God does not have a head. Well, you know, at least the way we normally understand, you know, God is not physical in that sense. But the concept.
Goofy, smart,
right,
goofy.
Right, right. But the concept is that the spiritual messages of what tefillin is that we have, God has as well. So I wanted you to see that pasuk because it's both in the liturgy and it's in God's tefillin. So if you ever ask, if you're ever asked to check God's tefillin and you open it up and you don't. And you don't find the Shema, you should not declare it pasul, because God's tefillin has a different set of parshiyots, right? So don't be concerned.
All right. On the Shara, they did find tefillin for women.
Interesting. That would be interesting.
They found it.
You know, again, according to rabbinic tradition, Michal, the daughter of Shaul, used to put on the tefillin every day. Now, I'm not sure if that's called a valid precedent or not, because Chazal do not criticize her for this. So, you know, on one hand, it seems to be a viable precedent. On the other hand, she's criticized for other things. I'm not sure if she would be the role model for that. But okay. But anyway, going back to Parakhet, there's one more pasuk I want to show you, and that is, look at verse 15, chapter 8, verse 15. This is kind of after he's conquered his enemies. Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael. He is now king over all of Israel. Vayihi David osem mishpat utztaka v'chol amo. David does mishpat and staka, justice and charity to all his people. Now the Talmud already points out that there seems to be a bit of a contradiction in these terms, because justice means I judge by the letter of the law, right? So you commit a crime, you know, you get the sentence. Mercy, or tzedakah, righteousness, charity, connotes the quality of compassion. So which was it? Was it mishpat, or was it tzedakah? So the Gemara gives the following example. If I sue you for money that you owe me, and the judge rules you have to pay me the money, look what the Gemara says. For me who gets the money, that's justice. And for you... you are getting compassion. You are getting charity. Not in terms of what you're getting, but you are being saved. Your soul is being redeemed. They tell the story. Somebody once asked the Chassam Sofer, one of the great rabbis 200 years ago, a butcher once said, you know, I often bring you animals that I slaughter, and if you tell me the animal is not kosher, I throw it away, and I'm perfectly happy to absorb that loss. But how come if I'm suing somebody for $5, or somebody's suing me for $5, whatever the money is, and I wind up paying him, I get so upset? I'm willing to throw away a $1,000 cow, but I get upset if I have to pay somebody $5. Why is that so? So the Chassam Sofer says a very simple explanation. When I say your cow is treif, nobody gets it. So you don't care if you lose it as long as somebody else doesn't get it. But when I say you got to pay $5, it's going to him. That gets you upset. The concept is that sometimes we're more upset, not by what we lose, but what we have to give the other guy and acknowledge that we're wrong. So Chazal actually say, when a person is forced to give up what is not rightfully theirs, they ought to be grateful. A favor is being done to them, that they're not in possession of something which is evil and which is improper. And that is called the mishpat utztaka. Now, the other interpretation the Gemara gives is a simpler interpretation. And that is, tzedakah refers to the obligation of every judge to try to bring the parties to a compromise. Meaning, mishpat means we do have a definite law, which we will impose if the parties cannot agree, but the first thing we strive to do is to bring the parties to their own agreements so that they don't have to go to court or whatever it is. That is called peshara, where you bring the parties to their own settlements. We know that even in the secular system, right, settlements are often encouraged. And indeed, different judges are different personalities about this, but some judges are so adamant about settlements, they kind of lock lawyers in a room in the judge's office and say, don't come out of here till you come to a settlement. Part of it is because judges, you know, have so many cases, they don't want to have a trial. They just want to, you know, get rid of as many cases as they can get rid of. But in halakha, too, we strongly encourage people to come to settlements in which they amicably resolve their differences.
Doesn't the American law say justice without mercy is not justice, or what else?
Yeah, there's a saying.
Well,
like
I'd
that.
Rather saying go.
Well, I think that basically is what you say.
You don't remember yourself.
I don't remember the exact word. Okay. But the thing is that, okay. But this is the idea of mishpat and staka. Okay. Chapter 9, we mentioned, although I want to add a few details later on. Chapter 9 is David is, in other words, now that David is kind of settled in terms of his enemies, he's looking for, you know, ways to be a nice person, etc. And he wants to do chesed to any surviving descendants of Yonatan. And here you recall there's one surviving son, Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth was lame because in the final campaign against the Philistines that resulted in Shaul's death, he was dropped as a young child. Of course, again, as I say, the chronology here is totally off, because if he was a young child, at a maximum, this is 7 years after that. Right? In other words, because David just came to Jerusalem, so Mephibosheth couldn't be that old, and yet we are told that he already has a son himself. But be it as it may, Mephibosheth is lame, and David takes him in, and David says, you will be my personal, you will live in my home, live in Jerusalem, and you will eat at my table. Now, in Perek Tet, there is a certain person who's introduced who, we're not told a lot about him here, but he does have some interesting stories later on in the book of Shmuel, so I want to just bring them together. And that is a fellow called Siva. Look in chapter 9 and verse 2. Lebeit Shaul Evet. The house of Shaul had a slave. Ushmot Siva. His name was Siva. And Siva was the one who actually gave David information regarding the whereabouts of Mephibosheth. Now, what do we know about this person, Siva? Well, Siva did very well as a slave. You know, you might think a slave is oppressed and the like, but we are told that this Siva, number one, had a very large family. He had 15 sons, which is fine, and he had 20 slaves.
He himself had slaves?
Yes. So
a slave has slaves?
Well, apparently, well, what probably happened here was, in the anarchy that just followed the death of Shaul and the various civil wars, so Tziva just became a self-emancipated slave, and he kind of, whatever, he played the stock market, whatever it was, he did well. Maybe he appropriated assets from Shaul, we don't really know, or maybe he was just his own industry. And we are told that at this point he was doing pretty well. He had 20 slaves of his own, but David now says, well, you are after all a slave of Shaul's house. I hereby put all of your family in charge of managing Mephibosheth's estate for the benefit of Micha. That's Mephibosheth's son, kind of a trustee, but Mephibosheth will be my personal guest. So at this point, Siva seems to have lost his freedom, and Siva once again reverts back to being the slave, although, as far as we know, he didn't lose his own slaves, so even a slave could have a slave. It reminded me a little bit... one thing I remember in one of Chekhov's plays, as he describes how everybody in Russia had to have a servant. So there was a person who was so poor that all he had was water in his house. He had no food, but he had to have somebody who boiled his water. This was in Tsarist Russia. This person's job was to boil his water every day. You know, so that's kind of, so even the slave could have the slave. Now, the reason why I bring this up because Siva does make an appearance a little later on, and that is towards the very end of the book. And I'm going ahead, just if you remember, when Avshalom drives David out of Yerushalayim and David flees the city, so Tziva miraculously shows up with a whole bunch of food and provisions and donkeys to supply David's very exhausted men as they are fleeing Jerusalem. And David quite logically asks, and where is your master Mephibosheth? And Siva concocts a story. When Mephibosheth heard that you're being driven out of town, Mephibosheth says, oh, now is the opportunity for my father's malchut to be reestablished. And of course, that's kind of an illogical story, because Avshalom is establishing his own monarchy. But Siva paints the picture of Mephibosheth now conspiring with Avshalom to somehow restore the house of Saul. And at that point, David hereby declares to Tziva, I hereby give you all of the property. And of course, David doesn't know if he's going to come back yet, but he says, as of this date, all of Mephibosheth's property goes to you, Tziva. Now, it then turns out, when David comes back to Jerusalem, Mephibosheth is the first person to greet him. And Mephibosheth is wearing torn clothes, and he has, this is all in the Pasuk, and he has dirt on his head, and he says he hasn't bathed since David left because he was in deep grief. And David says, well, why didn't you come with me? And he says, well, I was going to come with you. I told my servant to go, put saddles on the donkeys. And then when I come out, he left. So David then says to Tziva, okay, I'll split the property between Mephibosheth and you. Meaning to say, at this point, David himself seems to have been confused who's telling the story, so he splits the property. So Tziva still winds up being okay, because Tziva gets 50% of the property. But it is interesting that Tziva tried to escape his servitude by concocting, apparently, a baseless accusation against Mephibosheth. So remember Tziva, that he does pop up a little later on in the book of Shmuel.
Did you tell him? Did you tell us why he was named Mephibosheth? It's a terrible name. To be shaved.
Again, Mephibosheth literally means from my mouth there is shame. Now, according to
who named him?
Well, okay, again, remember we've said this a number of times, that names in Tanakh do not even necessarily refer to what you were named at birth, and it does not even refer to what people called you. It refers to, from the perspective of the writer, a name may describe a certain element of character. According to Chazal, Mephibosheth was a phenomenally gifted Torah scholar. And in fact, he was King David's teacher. He was David's teacher of Torah. And Mephibosheth meant that whenever he taught Torah, everybody else was humiliated because there was no way they could compete with him. So Mipi, from his mouth, from my mouth, is Bosheth. There is humiliation, meaning people were, they could not compete with him. So in that sense, it's considered to be a tribute to his learning and his knowledge of Torah. Alrighty, so that's the story in Perek Tet, and that is David's kindness to Mephibosheth. Okay, we now come, chapter 10 refers to, chapter 10 again is a difficult story. Remember the nations here. Lot had two daughters, right? From the oldest daughter, a child was born who is Moab. And from the younger daughter, a child was born that is called Ammon. Both Moab and Ammon live Transjordan, in the eastern part of the eastern bank of the Jordan River. David had already subjugated Moab, but apparently David still wants to be on friendly terms with Ammon, with the Ammonites. And in fact, we are told that when the king of Ammon lost his father, or when the new king lost his father, who had been the old king, right? Kind of like in Jordan, actually, Ammon is basically where Jordan is. Ammon, in fact, Ammon is related to Ammon. That's the origin of the name. So David sends a delegation to comfort the king, who is in mourning, right? So this was not a hostile gesture at all. And a number of the Ammonites feel that this was a hostile spy mission or whatever it is. So they do something to humiliate the soldiers. And what is described is really very, very unusual. I don't know how common it was in other situations. They cut off half of their beards. So they had a beard on this side of their face, and they were shaven on this side. And they cut their clothing down to the buttocks, and in a way in which some of their buttock was exposed, kind of everything was half, right? Shaven, unshaven, covered, uncovered. And the men were not given any other clothing to take with them, so they were extremely humiliated, embarrassed, and David tells the people, wait in Jericho. Jericho apparently was not heavily populated, just wait there till your beards grow back, and you can get new clothes. And David then really declares tremendous war against the Ammonites, and this war goes on for a number of chapters, and this war is the backdrop for the story of David and Bathsheba. In other words, it is during this war with Ammon that the story of Bathsheba happens, and in fact Uriah, who is Bathsheba's husband, gets killed by the Ammonites because David puts him in the front lines. And this, yeah.
But what kind of instance was here where they had beard cut before
another family? I don't recall it being earlier. I'll check, but I think this is the first time we had the half beard. I think so. I think so. But I will check that. Now, chapter 11, of course, brings us to the very, very famous story of David and Bathsheba. Remember, this is during a war with the Ammonites. David is on his roof. He sees a woman bathing. According to some rabbinic tradition, she was actually going to the mikveh after menstruation, so she was purifying herself from a nidah. She is beautiful. He is attracted to her. And he basically doesn't rape her. There's certainly no indication of rape, and that's not the accusation, but he summons her to him. They lie together. They are intimate. Well, it could very well be that realistically she had no choice, but as far as we know, this was not something in which there was physical coercion, because that's the one thing that even Natan the prophet does not accuse David of doing. And then, of course, Bathsheba then says she's pregnant, right? Kind of a story that repeats itself in many messages. You know, I'm pregnant. What do I do? And David is a bit clumsy here. There's not a lot that David is able to do. Remember, this is before DNA and blood tests and everything else. So David wants to concoct a story that, oh, well, let's get it so that her husband made her pregnant. It's a cover-up. We'll just say that this is her husband's child. So the only problem is her husband's away at war. So David decides to be generous, and he grants this Uriah. He sends a message that Uriah should be given a furlough to go home and visit his wife. And Uriah is a very... right. And the assumption is he'll be with his wife, and then if 9 months later a baby is born, it'll just be assumed that this baby was Uriah's baby. By the way, he's called Uriah. Uriah means light of God, but that's his name, right? Uriah, like in David Copperfield. Uriah ha-chiti. Now, chiti is a problematical term, and we had this over and over again, because chet is one of the, chet with chet datuf, is one of the seven nations of Canaan, the chiti. Now, these are non-Jews, and they're supposed to have been wiped out, so what do we mean chiti? Because clearly the assumption is that if Bathsheba is Jewish, presumably she's married to a Jew, it wouldn't be an intermarriage, that at least from the standpoint of halacha. So again, the commentaries tell us that the designation Chiti, the Hittite, can either mean he lived geographically in territory that was Hittite territory, or it could refer that his ancestors were Hittites. But remember, there could still be conversion. Remember, Maimonides writes, even against the seven nations, there's Kriyat Shalom and the opportunity to make Shalom. So the assumption clearly is, at least under conventional understandings, that he was a Jew, either by conversion or by birth, and therefore Bathsheba was married to him. Now, I'll go back to the issue of whether she was married at the time or not, but here's the thing. So David tries to make it out that Uriah will be with his wife, and then he'll just pass off the child as Uriah's child, and David won't get in trouble. The problem is, Uriah refuses to go home. Even though he's summoned from the front, he lies in front of the palace on the ground with other soldiers, and he basically says, and David says, go home, I'm giving you a vacation. And Uriah says to David, how can I go home and enjoy domestic life when my fellow soldiers are fighting and giving their lives? He was a real Marine. He basically said, I don't want a break. I'm going to stay out here till you send me back to the front. Yeah.
There are two kinds of wars. One that they're obligated to fight, another one,
Right.
What kind of war was this?
Well, as far as I can see, this is an optional war because the obligatory wars are either a destruction of the seven nations of Canaan, of which Ammon is not, okay? or a war against Amalek, which Ammon is not, or a defensive war when you have been attacked. Now, as far as I can see, Ammon engaged in hostility and humiliation of a small group of people, but as far as I could see, David initiated this war as retaliation for this humiliation. This would not constitute, I don't think, a defensive war in and of itself. But the king still has the authority to declare such a war. So now David has to have another strategy. See, David's strategy is, my optimal strategy would be to pass off this kid as Uriah's kid. Of course, I mean, that itself raises a lot of problems. I mean, would David have paid child support? I mean, was David's plan to totally deny that this was his child? I mean, that itself is very problematical, but that didn't work. Well, again, though, but that doesn't work simply because Uriah's not going to be with his wife. So what's going to happen, right? Jews don't believe in immaculate conception. So the alternative is, okay, I'll get Uriah killed, and then I'll marry her. And then, 9 months later, you know, we'll have a kid, or 8.5 months later, little, because from the marriage. And then it'll be my child, but that'll be fine because people will just figure I married a war widow, and they will not figure I committed adultery. Right? That's the simple meaning. And, of course, David doesn't want to kill Uriah, because if he kills Uriah and then marries Bathsheba directly, people are going to figure something was fishy. So what he does is he sends a message to his erratic but very, very skillful general, Yoav, who, of course, is David's nephew, and says, put this guy in the front. Now, just, you know, some, after all, somebody has to be in the bed, right? Somebody has to be in the front lines. So let it be him instead of somebody else. And David is kind of hoping, you know, maybe he'll get killed in this battle. And, of course, Uriah gets killed in the front. David didn't do it. Uriah got killed in a...
David even claims that the other people just fall back. Joab,
right. That's correct. That's correct. That's right. David wanted to be a little more sure that this would happen. And he kind of indicated that if Uriah finds himself in a vulnerable place, there ought to be a bit of a strategic retreat so that he will be exposed. Yoav, it's a very good point. Yoav did not go that far. Yoav could not see himself abandoning a person. But as it happens, Uriah did get killed anyway. And then David is really happy. I mean, David now marries Bathsheba. Everything is fine. He marries a war widow, and they have a baby. And everything is fine.
The baby died.
Well, that's a little later. But initially they have a baby. Now, here's the thing. It's interesting that Bathsheba, we are told her father's name. We know nothing else about her father except one more detail, which I'll tell you in a second. And her father's name is, what does it say, in verse 11? Eliam, yeah. Bathsheba Bas Eliam. Now, this name is repeated somewhere else. And the only other detail we're given is that Eliam was a son of Achitophel. Now, if Eliam is the same person in both contexts, that indicates Bathsheba's paternal grandfather was Achitophel, which is fascinating. Achitophel was the closest advisor of David who went over to Avshalom and became disloyal, and later committed suicide when he realized that David would be coming back. So some commentators want to draw a connection that Achitophel's later defection of David, from David, occurred as a result of what David's injustice towards Bathsheba. So some actually want to make the connection that way. Because otherwise, it's a little enigmatic. Achitophel was a very, very close advisor of David, and why he switched loyalties is really not explained. Okay, now, be it as it may, basically, if you read chapter 11, and of course the later rebuke of Natan the prophet, you get the impression that David is guilty of a whole bunch of things. Number one, even he's guilty of adultery with a married woman. Number two, he's guilty of indirectly causing the murder of an innocent man. Number three, his original plan, he would have denied paternity and not taken care of a child that would have been his child. It seems to be a very, very despicable thing. Now, we do know that the Talmud can have a very famous interpretation which mitigates significantly the behavior of David by reference to the following halakha. It is recorded that when soldiers went out to war, soldiers would always give their wives a get. They would always divorce their wives before they went out to war. And the reason this was done was that in case they're missing in action, their wives should not be agunot and be permitted to marry. Because, you know, in Judaism, we do not have a presumption. Now, in secular law, if a person has an unexplained absence for 7 years or so, he is presumed dead, and his wife is allowed to be married, huh? Yeah. Let me finish the thought. So, you know, I understand. Yeah. So the thing is this. So the thing is that since in halakha there is no such thing as an unexplained absence, meaning if somebody is absent, you assume that they're alive unless you have no evidence to the contrary. So in a missing in action, in fact, that's a real aguna. You know, today we use the word aguna primarily for women whose husbands don't give them a get, which is, you know, that's a serious problem. But the classic use of aguna is the disappearing or vanishing husband, where we don't know if they're dead or alive. So this would be a very great hardship on women who could not marry, even if their husbands are likely to be dead, but there's no evidence. So consequently, the expedient was that every soldier would give a get to his wife, with the understanding that if I don't come back after, and they would stipulate, after a year, after 2 years, after 3 years, you can marry. So even if I show up later, you know, you can marry and it's not adultery. Now, the expectation, however, was, that if I showed up, we would get remarried again. In other words, the concept was not, here is a get, go get married tomorrow. Rather, here is a get that you shouldn't use unless I'm gone for X number of years. But the expectation was that if I came back, you know, within that X number of years, we would have a new marriage ceremony. Consequently, according to this, the Gemara argues that when David was with Bathsheba, it was not adultery, technically, because technically she was not a married woman. She was not a married woman. She was a single woman. And consequently, it was only adultery in the moral sense and not the legal sense. It was adultery. See, it clearly is adultery in the moral sense. It's adultery in the moral sense because it was a betrayal. Clearly, she was supposed to go back to Uriah. But it was not adultery in the legal sense. See, because if it was adultery in the legal sense, even after Uriah's dead, David couldn't marry her. Remember, we discussed this halacha. If a woman commits adultery, she cannot marry the guy she committed adultery with. That also would have meant the child that would be born would be a mamzer. So how could David conceal that, right? So the Gemara gets around the technicality. In fact, the Gemara even says that even David sending Uriah to his death could have had a technical justification, because Uriah defied a direct order of the king in time of war. If the king orders you, go home, and you defy the king's order in time of war, that is called Mared B'Malchut, that is treason against the king, which is a capital offense. So, one thing I want you to understand, people always say, well, that's whitewashes, right? But the point is this. Obviously, in the book of Shmuel, there's no whitewash, because Natan HaNavi calls David both an adulterer and a murderer. In other words, I think the lesson here is the other way around. Instead of looking at it as a whitewash, the lesson is you don't evade divine responsibility by legal technicalities. Meaning to say, the Talmud says perhaps David did have legal technicalities in his favor, but in God's book, that doesn't wash. So you look at it the other way. In other words, David did have an excuse, so to speak, but that excuse did not suffice. Yeah.
I have a comment and a question about verse 11, where the Lord says, "My fellow soldiers are out in the field fighting. How can I?"
Yeah, Uriah says. Yes.
How can I?
How can I go home? Right.
Eat and drink and right. Die with my wife.
Right.
And I heard this rabbi in Israel just before Rosh Hashanah was talking about it, and it developed from this sort of a halacha relating to Pidyon Shvuyim, where he said that it is a halakha when the people are at war that you are not supposed to be involved in gaiety, you know, that you are supposed to give all your funds to prosecuting the war, because it's not fair that you on one side are having a joyous banquet and they are fighting over there.
So, yeah. Well, I think that's right. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say everything, but it certainly indicates at a time when the Jewish people are engaged in a life and death struggle,
yeah,
it's not a time for a person to enjoy his own private pleasures. And Urya is really stating that concept of empathy and solidarity with those who are making sacrifices. I know of, I think, Rav Aaron Cutler's wife, great woman who died around 5 or 6 years ago. She did not eat chocolate from the time of the Holocaust on. I mean, she gave it to her grandchildren and her children, but she just said that she lost any taste for anything sweet. She said she could not eat anything sweet when she...
So are there halakhas like...
Well, there are halakhas. For example, there's a halakha that one should not have marital intercourse at a time of famine and starvation. Now, you might answer that's to keep the birth rate down, but it seems to be more of a concept of empathy with the sufferings of others.
But you know, in a more contemporary way, there's always this conflict of the soldiers who in Israel who are like in Lebanon, places like that, and then they come back to Tel Aviv and they're on visa dump with people are there, you know, just
right,
going through normal motions of life. So
right,
so it's always like written about in the paper.
Right.
It's always difficult for the soldiers.
Yes. Yes.
People enjoying themselves.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. 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 Well, you know. One of the most controversial issues in Israel today, actually, is the issue of who should be exempt from military service. Should there be a full-time exemption for people who are studying Torah? You know, that's a very, very controversial and burning issue, and people are going over this. Shouldn't the military burden be shared by everyone? On the other hand, doesn't the believing Jew also say the study of Torah provides some protection for people? So those are difficult issues. Certainly, when one gives his life, when one is potentially, you know, can lose his life and sees people who are not doing that, that creates a certain tension in the air. Well, you know, first of all, many Orthodox people do serve in the army. I mean, there's no question. You have Hester Yeshivot, and I think we can't describe uniform motives to everybody. You're dealing with a large population, and there are different motives and different purposes in each group. I mean, there are many people who are very, very sincere. In fact, there are even Hasidim who serve in the army. I'm not going to say a tremendous number, but you can see people with beards and peyote and the like who are actually in the army. Yeah.
Well, we did, but he seems to have moved into a new stage now. He's not out of the war anymore.
Right. Right. Although we will see, yes, it is a new stage. In fact, we will see an interesting point, though, that when Yoav solidifies the conquest of Ammon, and he's about to conquer Ammon, he then tells David, why don't you show up and finish it off, so people shouldn't give credit to me for doing the conquest. So there was a concept here of David as symbolic conqueror, meaning to say, all of the work is done, and then David shows up and whatever it is, pulls out the last brick, or whatever it is. But that is correct. I guess it's inevitable. You know, we will see, too, and later, that there are times when David wants to go out to war, and his own soldiers tell him, you don't do that, because we need you to create the strategy inside the palace. But it is true that David was not directly involved in this war. But again, as I say, this is an important chazal, but I would look at it not as an example of whitewash, but I would look at it as an example that whitewashing is not good enough, that because Natan the prophet clearly does not cut David any slack at all with all of these legalistic explanations that, according to Chazal, David could have offered. Yeah.
It's not that he's not tried, probably.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He's not executed. He's not even removed from office.
That's correct.
Nothing.
That's correct.
Everything that happens to him is in the natural and or divine realm.
Well,
none of that is that in the realm of human justice, which is called for, and
Well, of course, you do have a very simple problem, and that is, who is capable of judging the king? I mean, even Saul, you know, Shaul was not judged by a human court. Shaul's punishment was also divine. I mean, essentially, there is no mechanism by which the king is brought to human justice per se. But David did suffer tremendously. But let me just go over this. We of course have Natan the prophet's rebuke, and this is the famous parable of the poor person. It's a little bit of an odd metaphor in a sense. It talks about a poor man had this little sheep, little lamb, and this little lamb, it said, would be on his lap. He would share his cup. They would eat together from the same food. And the rich person needed a lamb to slaughter, and he took that little lamb and he slaughtered it. What should happen to the rich man? And David says, such a man is. It mentions two things. Such a man deserves to die. And such a man should make compensation fourfold. Now, that, by the way, is an allusion to a halakha in the Torah. The halakha is, indeed, if I steal something from you, the Torah says, not only must I make restitution, but I must pay double. So if I steal $100, I have to pay you $200. But there's a special rule. If I steal your sheep and I slaughter it, or I steal your ox, your bull, and I slaughter it. So for a sheep, I must make fourfold restitution. So if the $100 sheep, $400. For an ox, I must make fivefold restitution. This is in the book of Exodus. David is actually...
It's in the Torah.
It's in Exodus chapter 20. And David is actually alluding directly to the halakha. Somebody took my sheep and slaughtered it. Got to make fourfold restitution. Interestingly enough, the Talmud discusses why is a sheep four and an ox five. I mean, an ox is worth more than a sheep, but that's no reason why the multiple should be more. So the Gemara gives two reasons. One reason is that an ox is more valuable. A sheep was primarily used for wool and meat, but an ox could also be used for plowing and for agriculture. And therefore, the deprivation is so much more severe that we punish the thief more. But there's another explanation, which is a fascinating explanation. That is, if you're a thief and you steal a sheep, you're going to have to carry the sheep on your shoulders. Sheep don't move very fast. And therefore, you're going to be humiliated walking through the street with the sheep on your shoulder. And therefore, the embarrassment that the ganav suffers is enough to make your life a little easier. In other words, that's an unusual defense. The defense of the embarrassment of committing the crime. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like saying, you know, if I have to carry off the TV set, you know, it's embarrassing to schlep a TV set, you know. But it's as if it were that God counts that embarrassment as an extenuating factor. So David's reference to fourfold compensation is actually a mirror of a law in the Torah. David's statement, he deserves to die, does not correspond with any halakha. Certainly theft of property is not a capital offense. But as we say, this reflects David's outrage, right? Kind of the emotional outrage at this. And then Natan turns the tables and says, you are that man. And here David, of course, acknowledges, Chatati, I have sinned. Right. Well, the commentaries view this as very, very significant. They point out that when Shaul is confronted with Amalek and the like, Shaul equivocates and passes the buck and denies, and David, as it were, acknowledges, not publicly, but at least acknowledges to the prophet, to Natan, that he is guilty of this chet. He offers no explanation. He offers no exoneration that appears in the book. And Chazal see that as key to why, although he was punished, he was allowed to remain king, because a king can make a mistake and commit even very serious aveirot, but if he acknowledges his responsibility and does tshuva, at that point God will forgive him. There is a psalm, by the way, I think it's Psalm 54 in Tehillim, which is the psalm, it's called the Psalm of Repentance, which is attributed to David composing when he was going through the process of tshuva over Bathsheba. Now, if you look, I'm sorry.
Which one was that?
If you have a does anyone have a whole Tanakh here? I'm going to tell you exactly. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'll tell you exactly. Yes, it's 51. It says, "Lametzeach Mizmor LeDavid." Yeah, that's okay. The Bar Elav Natan Hanavi, when Natan the prophet came to him, Kasher Bar El Batsheva, when he had been intimate with Batsheva, and he says, "Chaneni Elokim, have mercy on me," etc. And it talks about like a famous verse, "Leif Tahar Barali Elokim, create for me a pure heart." Ruach Nachon Chadesh Bekirbi, and give me a good spirit. Al Tashlicheni Milfanecha, do not throw me away from yourself. Ruach Kadshecha Al Tikach Mimeni, do not take away your Holy Spirit from me. And again, they're different. Hashem Svasai Tiftach, God, open my lips. Upi Yagid Tehilatecha, and my mouth will declare your praises. Right, Shmona Esrei, see, all of these are taken. So this is actually taken from the Tehillim that David composed in light of Natan's meeting. Thank you.
Now, it is explained, but nevertheless, I'll ask the question. David was chosen to be king because of the metaphors of the way he behaved as a shepherd with his lamb.
Right, right.
How does a human being change so radically because he was no longer really so kind? In other words, I know you're going to say the kingdom changes people and...
Well, we don't deny the reality of these changes. I think
but
that
this was a person who was so pure, and when you read his tehillim, and this is also perhaps blasphemous, he seems to be a very, very how should I put it? He asks a lot to himself.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I love you and I glory in God's goodness.
Right.
But please don't kill me, or please be mm-hmm. good to me, mm-hmm. or please... Mm-hmm. I mean, he knows he's sinned, but
right,
he is
right,
always
right,
asking for his own personal safety.
Well, he had a lot of enemies. He had a lot of people
together. No, I know that,
but
he's like a very torn man as well. I mean, we talk about Shaul being torn.
Right, right, right.
Here's a man, too, that has a lot of dichotomous...
Yep, he's a complicated character, yeah. I mean, we don't see him with the depressions, the manic depressive thing of Shaul, that we don't see that much. But certainly we see a vacillation between compassion and cruelty that occasionally comes in. We see a lack of self-control at one level, but then we see tshuva afterwards, yeah.
How public will find the confrontation between Nathan and David? And they can find out God, or lots of people talked about it, so they
can find out.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
That's
a very interesting observation. Many commentaries point out that the general public, at least until David published the Psalm, we don't know exactly when he published the Psalm, just didn't know any of this. This was an entirely private event. No one knew that David was with Bathsheba. Nobody knew that Natan confronted him. And even when the various tragedies befall David in the aftermath of this sin, people did not necessarily connect it to that event. So what we know as readers was not largely known to the Jewish people.
The Solomon, when the Solomon is written,
yeah, probably.
Read, that's,
yeah.
That's that publicly issued or estimated at the time? Is that the understanding?
Yes, but we don't know exactly when that was issued.
At some point, there was a public confession.
At some point, there seems to be a public confession. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What can we know from the fact that David is so complicated, in some ways, horrible?
Yeah.
About what Hashem loves in a place. Mm-hmm. I mean, should we just forget it? Is there a lesson?
Well, I think the lesson is that there's a capacity for forgiveness even when you fail tremendously, when you acknowledge your wrongdoing and you step forward, you try to make amends. I think that is the lesson. I mean, part of the lesson is, well, again, in Tehillim and the like, you see that he spent his tshuva and the like, and the chatati, the acknowledgement of the guilt, is very significant, particularly if the Tehillim is a public statement, which it seems to have been at some point. We don't know exactly when there was even a public confession, a confession of this. David did not make any direct amends to Uriah's family. We don't know exactly. There's no indication of that. And perhaps there was no amends to be made. Maybe there was no family left. But as far as we know, there was a deep deep regret that David had. There is a statement in the Gemara, by the way, which I don't have fully understand. I'll just share it to you. It says that in truth, this was a sin that David... It was beneath David. This was not a sin that David should have been able to commit. And similarly, the sin of the golden calf was a sin beneath where B'nai Israel were. But God either allowed it or enabled it to happen to show that if a congregation sins, they could do tshuva, that's the Chet HaEgel, and if an individual sins, they could do tshuva. In other words, there seems to be somehow God allowed... In other words, normally God would protect a righteous person from some this type of base sin. God didn't protect. God wanted David to go all the way with this in order to show us the capacity of tshuva. Now, there's another Mamre Chazal that says that David had been feeling overconfident. David had been asking God. David was confident he had conquered the Yetzer Hara. So he turns to God and he says, "Challenge me, God. Send me something. I'll show you. I will not succumb." And that is the day, the night that he saw Bathsheba. So part of the lesson is also of hubris, not to have overconfidence, not to think that you've arrived and we're not prone to the basis that they wrote. It's a sober... Well, there is something called tshuva. Now, again, halakha is very clear that if I sin against another human being, the human being should forgive me if I try to make amends for what I did to that other human being. That's very true. However, short of that, there's no obligation to forgive. Well, okay, then we'll come to it. I mean, the child, as you know, died. The child was born alive, and the child died, and of course there's a very moving scene how David fasted and prayed, and his prayer did not help, and he was almost mad with grief as the child was dying. And when the child died, David's people said, "Oh, gee, what's going to happen now? Now he's going to go crazy." And David was very, very calm after the child died. He says, "As long as the child was alive, I prayed and I fasted because I had hope. Now that the child is dead, as David says, I will be going to him, but he will no longer be going to me." And then David said, "I have to go back to life. I have to resume life." So this child was not given a name. The child died within a week, or after a week. And Natan told David that the child that you have will
girl
die.
Girl or boy?
Boy.
It seems to be a boy, yes.
Seems to be.
It was before, it seems to be before, that's right.
Right.
That's an interesting observation.
What did he say?
No, he's saying the child is not given a name, so that might indicate the child died before a Brit. That's correct. Of course, you know, it is the custom, by the way, to this very day, if, God forbid, a baby boy dies before he had a Brit Milah, a Brit without a blessing, of course, is actually performed on the dead body, and the baby is given a name. He's given a name after. Yeah, even before. From the time that, you know, it's formed. From the time that the male is formed, yeah. Yeah.
This is what my question is. If he did tshuva, and I, from what I can see, it was genuine and very heartfelt.
Right.
Yet, after this, all of the relationships that David was involved in.
Yep. But that's what the prophet told him. Look at what Natan told him. Natan told David, a certain sequence of events is going to happen to you now. And look at the events, and then just compare the rest of the book of Shmuel, and you see each of those events happened. This is in chapter 12. Yeah. Verse 11. Koham HaHashem, so says God, Hinani Mekim Alecha Ra Mi Beitecha, I will bring forth evil from your very home. And that's a direct prediction of Avshalom and Amnon and Tamar, as we will see. V'lakachti et nashech el yeinecha, and your wives will be taken away from you. V'nasati l'riach will be given to your friend. Actually,